So the conversation goes to trauma and specifically looking at the concept of secondary trauma today. Bear with me if you heard me at the start of the show. I just want to repeat the story for the sake of those who weren't listening at 1 o'clock. Extraordinary video doing the rounds. News 24 has got it posted of a man walking into a pizza joint to pick up the focaccia that he had ordered online and opening the box to find that that focaccia didn't look like what he was expecting it to look like. He thought he'd ordered something which had cheese on top of it. He hadn't read the online order sheet properly. He'd pressed go and entered his details, etc. Long story short, got to the pizza place to pick up his order, flew into an absolute rage when he realized it wasn't what he thought he'd asked for, started being very abusive towards the staff, and next thing, pulls out a gun. And as he leaves the place, fires two shots into the air in a crowded space where people were working, cashiers were behind the till, other customers were sitting down at tables eating, waitresses were on duty. And I looked at that video this morning and I just thought, what an angry, angry country we live in and how deeply, deeply traumatized so many of us are and don't even realize it. It's the second time I'd have that thought in a couple of days, because last week my producer Kia was witness to a very nearly very serious bus accident, and she came in talking about how it had made her feel and the sort of shock that she'd felt and the trauma that she'd experienced as a witness to that event. And I had the same thought that even when crime does not affect us directly, even when accidents don't involve us directly, so much of what is going on in the world around us today, and particularly in this country, does expose us to a different level of trauma. And when we talk trauma, I always think of the guest who's with me in studio today, Debbie Rozovsky, who is a post-traumatic stress counselor, very knowledgeable on this and from a personal perspective as well, because she's been there and gone through it herself. Debbie, it's been far too long since we had you in studio. Welcome back to Cape Talk.
Thank you for having me. Lovely to be here.
Well, let's talk about a definition. Secondary trauma, what does it actually mean?
Secondary trauma is, and I'll give the example, is if my neighbor is burgled today, tonight I'm checking my doors locked 40 times and my mm-hmm. ears up the whole night listening for noises. So I'm not the primary target, but I feel the effects. And this often goes through from the primary target to the whole family and then the neighbors in the street and the community. So it's the secondary, and so is the witnessing.
Now, I said maybe we as a whole country suffer from this. I think it's almost impossible that we don't, because every single one of us, Debbie, knows somebody who has been affected by violent crime or knows of it happening close by to us within circles of our colleagues, our family, our friends.
That's exactly true. Most of us have secondary trauma and we're not aware of it. And we can have some of the symptoms also which we don't attribute to the witnessing or what happened to the neighbor or to our friends or family.
So there's a lot for us to talk about, including what those symptoms look like, what we do when we recognize that we have this. But let's just talk a little bit about symptoms of trauma per se. I think a lot of people know something about the way we respond when exposed to a dangerous or frightening situation. They might have heard the terms fight or flight, for example. Can you elaborate a little bit? What goes through the human mind and what's happening in the body when we're placed in the direct experience of trauma?
So when we realize something's going on, our conscious mind that we were thinking, perhaps I've got to go and buy milk and bread, goes on pause, mm-hmm. and suddenly the brain believes it's having a near-death experience. So it sends adrenaline to the most primitive part of our brain, and the brain decides in a millisecond, how are we going to survive? So it's either the fight, which most of us aren't in a position to do because the perpetrator is prepared and we are unprepared, or they have a weapon. The flight, our brain does a calculation to see whether there's space for us to run. Mm-hmm. And if there's not, then we go into a freeze. And that means we're totally obedient, calm. Some people see it from above. Some feel they're in a movie, often slow motion. And we become extremely obedient and we just go through the motions. The fourth symptom, which isn't really well known, is something called fawning, F-A-W-N-I-N-G, where we become very people-pleasing, and this happens a long time after the event, looking for visibility from people around us to be accepted, to be part of, and we can become fawners.
It's fascinating. It's almost like in our brain, subconsciously, we're going, if I behave a certain way, if I'm a good girl, this won't happen to me, I won't be at risk again. Is that what's going on, do you think?
Well, it's quite an interesting concept, because if you are, as I call it, invisible, anonymously going about your business, and then the perpetrator, the opportunist, whoever it is, suddenly comes for you, you're very, very visible to that man. You're trapped in their eyes. All you want to do is be invisible. Mm. Once he's gone, what do you want? Visibility. Your partner, the police, ADT, whatever, any security, you want that visibility. Then you go home and we sort of withdraw into ourselves with trauma. Mm-hmm. And we don't want people coming, sitting on the couch and staring at us because it can feel a little scary almost. And then after time, we want to be visible again. We want people to understand what's happening to us. Mm. But we have an emotional wounding. We don't have a physical wounding. So we can go from feeling invisible to too visible, and we just want to be around people, which makes us feel more secure.
So when it comes to secondary trauma, how does our response differ, if at all, from what you've described there in the primary response?
Well, the secondary response, often what happens for us is, as is in the primary, is that one trauma triggers old traumas. So the feeling comes up again of not being that safe in the world, mm-hmm. of not being that safe in our relationships. So it's not – our house represents us, our body. Mm-hmm. So when we're feeling very anxious, we want every door and window closed. When we're feeling better within ourselves, we can open the windows and doors. Mm-hmm. So it's quite symbolic. So we often get triggered about old stuff, and we can have some of the symptoms, which are something like trouble sleeping, and that could be because you're listening for noises, mm-hmm. trouble eating, being irritable or snappy, not feeling comfortable in your own skin.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's some sort of more subtle reactions, which is, for example, if you have small children and they become demanding, you're so busy listening for noises that you actually can't interact with them and they start irritating you.
Hmm.
So things like that.
It touches so many of us. And I think in a way we are a little bit the frogs in the pot in South Africa. We've gradually gotten so used to this, Debbie, that it feels normal. And sometimes it takes going away on holiday to another country and recognizing that actually the rest of the world doesn't necessarily live like this and accept this as normal. We've just gotten used to it. It's highly abnormal the way we live on edge and close to that trigger point in this country. I think we have to say that.
It's absolutely true. I found myself many years ago after I was in a bomb incident, going to Australia, and there was a loud noise. And, of course, I had that normal sort of Vietnam vet reaction, yeah. And I was beside myself with anxiety. And my friend laughed at me and said, it's just something or other. So we can do that. And then once we sort of get into the idea of being safe, it becomes scary to come back. Mm-hmm. So and then we become acclimatized again. And we have to function in order for our own feeling of peace in a way, as you mentioned, Kia's experience,
yeah.
where if she tells us the story of what happened, is that we keep it quite separate from ourselves because we have to protect ourselves. So we mm-hmm. say, gee, that's so awful. What you're having for dinner? And the person who's been through it says, can't you see what I've been through? So it's not being unkind. It's unconsciously protecting ourselves from that. Or we find out, was it an inside job? And if you hear it was, then phew, it's not going to happen to me.
Sure. Okay. It's amazing that the patterns of thought and how they sort of speak back to us, Debbie, as we try and make sense of the world around us and try and make ourselves feel safe within it. I just want to say to listeners, if you have suffered a trauma yourself or feel that you have shown symptoms of secondary trauma and you want to talk to us about what you went through, how you reacted, how long after the incident those symptoms appeared or disappeared, any insight you can share with us, you are very welcome to leave a voice note on 072-567-1567 or to call in on 021-446-0567, because I'm mindful that probably every person listening to this, Debbie, has been affected and touched by trauma in some way. Even if it is at a distance, I, as you sat down, I said to you, I looked at the TV screen behind you and the visuals are playing of the memorial service being held in Johannesburg for poor Enoch. The day we got that news, I was aware driving home that day, saying to myself, I was affected by that story more than I possibly should have been. And why was that? And for me, it was obvious. It's because the boy is the same age as my son. My son's about to go on camp. He's also a new grade 8 pupil. It was that feeling of uncomfortable closeness to my own story that I think made it sit so close to the skin for me. All of us have those stories, and we see ourselves and our family in the other people that these things happen to.
We do. And over the years, I've actually counseled the Cape Talk journalists because they do all these stories, they witness awful things, and most of the time they're fine until there's a story that triggers them personally.
Mm.
And then they come for the debriefing to see what's triggered them.
So what are the signs that you, because I think some of us don't even realize that it's happening. You've mentioned that the sleep disturbance, the irritation, the not feeling at ease as symptoms of having suffered trauma. Is that how it plays out with secondary trauma as well? Is that what you should be looking for?
Yes, but remember, it's not a prescription. So some people might react. There's usually a post and after trauma stress response, which lasts a few weeks or some a few days. But PTSD is a prolonged experience of trauma after over 6 months, and one really should get some help with that. So as I was saying to you, there's some very subtle symptoms that you don't attribute. So let's say somebody pulls your necklace off in the traffic. You don't expect to be irritable, to have changes in you can't eat, to feelings of loss, emotional feelings of loss, to anger, to looking for retribution. Well, those sort of make logical sense. But often it's people need to stay home if they've had something outside of their home. They need everything to be quiet and calm and predictable, very small boundaries for them to feel safe in the world. Now, one of the interesting things about adrenaline, which we need during the event, but what my job is to get people to get rid of the adrenaline, because it's the adrenaline that gives us the symptoms, which we get rid of, by the way, with exercise, with tears, because adrenaline comes out in tears, scientists have seen. Laughter. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We've got to empty our adrenaline. So what adrenaline is, it helps us during the event, and then it creates these symptoms. So one of the symptoms, for example, is every sense is very sharp. So if you picture a soldier in the war, he can hear better than he did before. He can smell stronger. He can feel someone close. He can hear someone standing on a leaf. So when we finished with our experience, or even the secondary experience, but it goes into our pores as well, then we can find the TV too loud. Isn't that interesting? It's fascinating. It's very subtle.
Just for those who might have joined us later to the conversation, I'm talking to a specialist in post-traumatic stress, Councillor Debbie Rozovsky, with us in the studio, talking about secondary trauma and this concept that it doesn't necessarily have to be a direct experience of violence or crime or tragedy to trigger trauma symptoms in you. In fact, in South Africa, most of us are exposed to at least some level of secondary traumatization. Debbie, I'm mindful of saying of the role we play in that, because the mere act of switching on the radio most days exposes you to stories that can trigger these feelings and make you feel unsafe and insecure and traumatized to a degree. It is simply all around us. So I'm fascinated by what you say about insulating yourself and creating that safe space. I know, I'm sure a lot of parents are listening. If a child has been exposed to trauma, if a child, for example, has witnessed a car accident, witnessed, God forbid, a shooting in front of them, so many kids have in Cape Town, how do we help them recreate that sense of a safe space around them?
Excellent question. But if the child is young, I work with the parents. They look to the parents to see if the world is safe or not. So I work with the parents, and one of the things I speak about is that even as adults, after an event, we need a prop. We need something to give us options. So people might feel, for example, that they can't shower if they've had a home invasion because they can't hear through the noise. They're listening for noises. Yeah. And they're naked. So one of the things I suggest is having a tin of Doom or deodorant in the shower with them. They won't need it. But just having a something brings down the anxiety. And my aim is to get people to bring out the adrenaline so that they feel more grounded. Mm-hmm. And if they see a lion in the road, they'll get more adrenaline.
The tin of Doom.
I wasn't expecting that.
Yeah.
I'll give you another great tip, which I learned many years ago from someone else. When you leave your home in the morning, you leave 200 rand on the entrance hall floor in full view. Put a little stone on it. All right. When you come home, if the money's still there, it means no one's been in your home. Because no one's going to leave money. And I thought that was a brilliant tip.
It's a lot safer than trying to put the hair across the front door that the spy will check to see whether someone came in the front door. You're looking to basically for tools to reassure yourself that your space is still safe.
And for children, they're like a bat or a whistle or a something, because it gives them something to do. One of the funny stories I did many years ago was a child who wouldn't get out of their parents' bedroom because if there was a noise, she was scared of the passage going at night.
Yeah.
So we did something, which was put a piece of string from the parents' bed. They happened to have a four-poster so we could tie it. And we had a little silver thing, don't remember what it's called, around the string and tied it to her bed, the daughter's bed. And the mom lay on her bed. This was during the day, and she lay on her, and she wiggled the string, and then her mother could see the string was going, and she came to the daughter, and the daughter settled because there was an option.
Just an actual physical sense of there is literally a connection here.
There's a connection
that keeps me safe, connected to my mom. That's fascinating. In terms of you've mentioned the role of exercise. I did want to go back to that because I know you literally take people through trauma release exercises themselves to sort of shake out the adrenaline. It is literally down to that physical level of needing to get it loose in your body, Debbie.
That's true. Yeah. So I've had a boxing bag in my office for 22 years. People found it very weird, but I've got proper gloves. And the idea is when you punch, you actually show your brain that you do have potency, but you couldn't use it at that time so that you stayed alive. Particularly for men, they have extra humiliation. Why didn't I, whatever it is, but you can't with a weapon at your head. So they feel quite shamed at their lack of action. But when they smash that bag, and they do, they can see how much power they have. So it's good for the brain, and it really releases the adrenaline out the body.
Absolutely fascinating. If you've got any questions for Debbie, we've got about 5 minutes left. Please do call in now on 021-446-0567 or send an SMS to 31567.
There are TRE classes, which is shaking classes, available. And also what I tell people to do is to put the music on at home, even if it's in the afternoon, and shake. They can pull their children into it, and you shake, and you do the twist, and you do all that sort of thing, and you just shake wildly, and often you just feel much more released. And it's fun for the children, and it's bonding if you do the conga through the lounge.
But literally physically letting your body let go, because this is, I think of all the knock-on impact of holding stress in the body and the cricks in the neck and the muscle tension and the headaches that follow from it. We literally spend so much time physically on edge. I'm aware of it, particularly now when I drive at night, that I am literally gripping the steering wheel so hard that I have to kind of consciously remind myself, you are actually safe. It's okay. Let go. You're driving defensively. You are aware of your surroundings or whatever it may be. But I have to almost physically talk myself down sometimes because without even realizing I'm doing it, your body tightens up in response to the perceived threat.
Absolutely. Yeah. And as silly as it sounds, please buy yourself a thin can of deodorant, one of those long ones. Keep it in your car because once again, you've got an option. To spray in someone's eyes.
In somebody's face.
Once you've got an option, it also settles you. You'll
I've also
never
got a teenage
it.
Son, so it's never going to go remiss to have deodorant in the car. Don't tell him I said that.
No, I won't.
Okay. We've got a caller on the line. Stan in Aranya Zucht. Welcome. Glad to have you with us this afternoon.
Hi, Pippa. A year and a half ago, I left a game reserve near the Mozambique border for an early flight from Nelspruit to Johannesburg. And I got caught up in a service delivery protest. I drove, it was like 4 o'clock in the morning, and I was on my own with some trucks on the road. And suddenly there was like 150 people storming out of out of the side of the road and then attacked my vehicle with bricks and all kinds of stuff. But the interesting thing was that I made a U-turn, tried to get away. And as I pulled away, a pain shot through my body. My lower back, like I literally couldn't move. And all I said to myself was, if I now pass out or something, something very bad is going to happen. But what is interesting from a physical point of view was that I literally got this massive pain through my back. I got away, and then about 200 meters away, it got better and I was fine. But the physical reaction to me was the most. I never went for anything more. I have no idea what the post scenario was. I thought it was. I always wanted to know why that physical reaction happened, the physical pain, and then the numbness in the body. And then as I got away, it went away.
That's really interesting, David.
It is interesting because normally adrenaline makes sure that you feel no pain until after the event so that you can survive the event. Yeah. So I haven't heard that before, that you felt the pain during.
Yes, and it physically, literally, they were still on the car.
Wow.
And as I pulled away, that happened, and that was to me the most frightening thing because I thought that something is going to happen to me and I can't get away. But luckily I got away and then got another road, found a way to the airport, went to the meeting forgot about it in italics. But,
sure.
But that to me, the physical, the physical thing to me, the immediate physical thing was very interesting. Yeah.
It is to me too. But what happened then was that your adrenaline was kicked in because you didn't feel the pain thereafter. So we go into what I call that numbness. But you always thaw afterwards. If you think of people who've frozen, eventually they thaw. So sometimes people come to me 2 years after an event when they're suddenly overwhelmed with emotion.
That's fascinating. So it's not necessary. These things don't follow a time pattern or a set pattern, Debbie. It may be that long after the effect that you actually start actually confronting and feeling the after effects.
Because what often happens is people come too soon for counseling. The next day, they absolutely feel fine. People around them might be crying, but they don't feel anything. They're just going about their business because they're still numb. So the adrenaline knows when to start, but it doesn't know when to end. And that's the problem for humans. Animals shake off the adrenaline when they get away, and they're fine. So that's the problem in humans.
You've given us a lot to think about, Debbie, and I've got several people asking for the spelling of your surname and how to make contact with you, please. So let's finish there, if you would. Yeah.
Okay, so my website is www.debbierozowsky.co.za.